talking to Trump about climate change today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President-elect Donald Trump has said climate change is a hoax, but this scientist thinks Trump would be open to hearing this.
It is more expensive to ignore this problem than it is to do something to fix it.
Also, a woman from Kosovo was ready to move to the U.S., but that was before the election.
You know, my fear before the election was that hate groups would feel liberated after a Trump victory, and it turns out that's exactly what happened.
Plus, a new hotline in Sweden to help stop mansplaining.
The calls have come in from all over Sweden, and from my point of view, I've had pretty much 50-50 men and women calling in.
That's all ahead today here on The World. Thank you for being with us today. It's been a week since the election, and there's still a lot to get your head around. In a moment, what the election means for many Mexicans who count on money from families in the U.S. that could now stop if President-elect Trump has his way. But we're going to start today with one topic that affects the whole planet, global warming. President-elect Trump has in the past dismissed climate change as a hoax made up by the Chinese, and he's promised to pull the U.S. out of the latest global agreement to fight climate change. But Trump is already walking back some of his campaign promises, so could he change course on climate as well? Atmospheric scientist and climate educator Catherine Hayhoe of Texas Tech University says the signs don't look good for that so far, but she holds out some hope if the right people can reach Mr. Trump with the right message.
The biggest thing that I have found in talking with people who don't agree with me over the last 10 or 15 years is that the most important thing is to build bridges. Not to focus on what divides us, not to march up with 3 feet of scientific reports in hand and smack them down in front of somebody and say, this is what all the scientists in the world say and you disagree with them. That's emphasizing immediately the differences between us. The most effective way forward, I have found, is to connect, first of all, over a value or a concern that we genuinely share. And studying climate change as I do and studying its impacts on us humans, there is no shortage of ways that climate change affects us that we can connect with people across the entire political spectrum on.
So you're an evangelical Christian and you spend a lot of your time talking to other evangelicals about climate change, right? So, I mean, evangelicals were crucial to Donald Trump's victory. What do you need to tell Donald Trump to keep him from walking away from the UN climate agreement?
My message to all of us would be that the Paris Agreement matters to us personally. It is put in place by just about every single country in the entire world because we have recognized that it is more expensive to ignore this problem than it is to do something to fix it.
But how do you convince a climate change denier businessman president that walking away from the Paris Agreement would be bad for business?
Well, I think the answer to your question is actually in the question itself. The solution to moving forward is to identify common values and common benefits with common solutions, such that these solutions, whether they are clean energy solutions, whether they are fear of falling behind China in our technology, basically the next moon race is to renewable energy, whether it is investing in the local economy, because, for example, here in Texas, when you build a new power plant, if that new power plant is powered by natural gas or by coal, it creates 8 times less jobs than if the same amount of electricity were generated locally by wind or solar. So there are many different benefits to moving forward. And the key is to identify those arguments or those benefits and those values that we already do genuinely share with whoever it is that we're talking with.
What if people like you can't build those bridges and bonds? What's at risk in the next few years?
Well, it definitely takes two. You can only extend the bridge, you know, halfway across the river, and then the person on the other side has to help. So what happens if the federal government over the next 4 years decides we have absolutely no interest in engaging on issues of climate, or even worse, honestly, we have no interest in engaging on issues of renewable and clean energy, and in fact, we want to try to turn the clock backwards? What happens then? Well, first of all, at the international level, the Paris Agreement will continue, although it will certainly be weaker without the contribution of the United States. Below the federal level, cities are already building their resilience to a changing climate. Cities are a huge incubator for carbon mitigation and for reducing emissions. And the clean energy economy, is already moving forward. I mean, just a few weeks ago, Elon Musk released a new set of shingles plus a power wall that you put in your garage that apparently is priced at only about $7,500 or $8,000, which is amazing. I mean, who doesn't want shingles that grow your own energy on your own roof?
That's pretty
cool. These things really give me hope that we are moving in the right direction. And that momentum has very little to do with federal action. But here's the big but. We are seeing a massive amount of change that is already impacting us today. So the issue today is simply an issue of time. We have to move faster. The momentum is there. The technologies are coming online. The desire for change is real. The question is, can we do it fast enough to avoid dangerous impacts? That is the question.
Catherine Hayhoe is the director of the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech in Lubbock. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Something else Trump has threatened to do, stop people here from sending money back home to their families in Mexico. The wire transfer is known as remittances. They are a big deal for the Mexican economy. Some $24 billion flow into the country through remittances. Like many of Trump's plans, though, he's not provided a lot of public details. But he says holding back remittances is at least one way to make sure Mexico pays for his border wall. The World's Monica Campbell is in Mexico City. She told me how remittances work and why they'll be tough to stop.
A lot of this money is sent through official channels, so like Western Union's, MoneyGrams of the world. People go to those places in the United States. They send the money, and people here in Mexico go to the bank and collect it. A lot of this money is also sent through informal channels, which means people bring it themselves through cash or send it to people visiting Mexico. But if things really tighten and it's harder for people to send money through formal channels or it becomes more expensive, what we'll see is a lot of this money will go underground and it'll be harder to track. And, you know, people are going to find a way to support their families.
As you speak with people in Mexico City, what kind of anxiety are you hearing? Or are you hearing anger that this whole remittance thing is being framed as a way to pay for the wall?
I think people are expecting that Trump is going to be saying a lot of things like this. I mean, it's not just about remittances. He's also talked about other things. And I talked to Michelle Mittelstadt about this, about the other proposals that Trump has been putting out there in terms of his desire to have Mexico pay for the wall. And Michelle Mittelstadt at the Migration Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. said this.
Do keep in mind that the Trump campaign also raised the possibility of trade tariffs or more vigorous enforcement of certain trade rules, the possibility of increasing visa fees, for example, or canceling visas.
So what could happen is that if Trump can't do what he wants in terms of curtailing remittances sent by Mexicans in the United States to Mexico, that there are other things that he can do to, in a sense, raise money. And what we'll see next is, you know, what will Mexico do? Because the idea is that perhaps Mexico would be facing a recession or a real hit on its economy if it absorbs these attacks. Maybe it will say, okay, let's work on the wall, which sounds outlandish in some ways, but maybe there will be some real politic going on there. We're not sure how this is going to play out.
Yeah. I mean, what plans does Mexico have to either stop Trump's plan or deal with the economic consequences of it?
Mexico's in wait and see mode, and they're waiting to see, you know, is this bluster or is this real policy? Unfortunately, Mexico is in not the best position when it comes to leveraging. Mexico has some leverage when it comes to the migration issue. At the same time, they're huge trade partners. 85% of Mexico's trade is with the United States. That's going to be really hard to unwind.
You know, it's kind of ironic. Labor doesn't typically have the ability to move, but the capital of elites does. And this proposal, if it goes through, would stop the capital of the labor classes. Bottom line, there will be a lot of angry people.
There will be a lot of angry people. And when you cut off that money, I hate to see what would happen in response. I mean, what could happen is that you'll have people decide to go north. So this could backfire greatly if Trump just thinks that cutting off remittances is going to stem, you know, the number of Mexicans going north. That could absolutely be the reverse.
The World's Monica Campbell in Mexico City. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Vested interests are, don't you know, a big factor in U.S. politics. And there are a few folks in the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia with some serious vested interests in what happens here in America. And I mean that literally. The campaigns that monopolized our lives for the past 18 months, they've given these Macedonians jobs, generating and circulating false news and getting them advertising dollars. BuzzFeed News has been digging into this, and I'm joined now by BuzzFeed's Craig Silverman. So tell us how this all works, Craig.
So there's a fairly large group of young people in Macedonia who for a long time have been running kind of dubious on the edges websites about different topics, whether it's health or other things. And at some point early in 2016, they started to realize that there was a lot of traffic to be had and money to be earned by running websites that were about U.S. politics, and in particular, very pro-Trump websites. So we found roughly about 140 U.S. politics websites that had been registered in one small town in Macedonia.
Wow. Give us an example of a story, Craig, that they put out that got a lot of attention.
The biggest hit for a Macedonian site that we saw was a false quote from Hillary Clinton. And so they had a story. It's gotten over 480,000 shares, reactions, and comments on Facebook. And the quote was that Hillary Clinton said in 2013 she would like to see people like Donald Trump run for office. She never said that. And that was, up until Election Day, their biggest hit.
So, I mean, how do you actually get a cut of dollars from 400,000 views on Facebook? How are these kids getting this money?
So Facebook is the engine that drives the traffic. They're not really earning money directly from Facebook. What they need is people on Facebook to read these stories, to click on them, to share them. And that sends traffic back to the website. And on their website, typically they were running Google AdSense, which is, you know, the dominant digital ad network out there. And so the more people who came to their site, the more people who viewed those pages, the more money that they would earn at the end of every month.
So how much could a kid in a Macedonian village make for, you know, a story on a fake Hillary Clinton quote going viral?
You know, a story like that may have earned somebody a few thousand dollars, but that's, you know, in the span of a few days. So that's actually pretty good when you think about it, and especially for the economy in Macedonia. And the people I spoke to who are running these sites, they all pointed to the fact that the economy is not great. This is a way to earn a little bit of extra money. And so some of them are certainly earning thousands of dollars a month. And I think the ones who got in on this very early, in early 2016, have maybe had months where they were doing, you know, more than $10,000.
Well, as you know, Google and Facebook both say they're now looking at ways to stop this kind of thing, especially the fake stories. But can they?
It's a difficult problem, and I don't think they can ever stop fake content on the internet. You know, there have always been hoaxes. People have always put this stuff out there. There are always going to be false claims and false stories that circulate. But I do also think that there's more for them to do. And Google announcing that it would start removing fake news websites from its AdSense program is a big thing, because that economic motivator is a big thing, whether you're in Macedonia or in the United States.
Well, as much as Americans may have a problem with these Macedonian kids, they're kind of genius making money off American gullibility. What's next for these kids?
Well, look, we found a lot of sites being run by folks in this particular town. You know, the Trump stuff was really seems to be the flavor of 2016 for them. But there are a lot of sites about, you know, motorcycles, and there are a lot of sites about health. And I think they're just constantly looking to see what English language internet users are going to spend a lot of time clicking on and looking at. And so I wouldn't be surprised if there are entirely new waves of different kinds of sites as we get into the end of this year and into next year.
Craig Silverman with BuzzFeed News. Thanks very much for this.
Thank you.
You're with the world. Back in 1999, NATO began a U.S.-led bombing campaign to protect Kosovo from a Serbian crackdown. Serbia was not happy, to say the least. So Donald Trump's coolness toward NATO has actually gone down well in Serbia. But for Kosovo, it's a different story. Kosovars see the U.S. bombing campaign as what saved them. Today, the U.S. is loved in Kosovo among the majority Muslim population. So with President-elect Trump, Kosovars are wondering what might happen now to their close ties with America. Here's reporter Nate Tabak from the capital Pristina.
Fitim Krasnici's obsession with the U.S. presidential race began during the primaries, and he felt the burn for months. More recently, he found himself impressed by Donald Trump, not his politics. Krasnici happens to be a devout Muslim, but he was impressed by Trump's ability to get attention and the sheer value of his name brand.
So I thought to myself, it is a great idea, like, to just jump on the bandwagon and just promote our little country here in Kosovo.
That idea became a website, Kosovo If Trump Wins. He created it with his older brother and a colleague. It cheekily suggested that Americans should move here in the event of a Trump victory. It was really just a ploy to bring traffic to an online travel guide. But for good measure, it profiles a few Americans who live here. It was a short-term gimmick, says Fitim's brother, Kustrim.
We were thinking about changing the domain name because we were sure that Donald Trump would lose this election.
But Trump won, and the website suddenly crashed because of all the traffic, about 10,000 page views in a day.
I couldn't believe it. I still don't believe it.
But they figured Donald Trump might not appreciate their success. These guys are Muslims, making a living doing outsource work, coding web and design, much of the business from the U.S., and a steep discount for what someone would earn in the U.S.
We're like the Donald Trump's nightmare. It's a bit scary to now think of like the worst-case scenario that's going to happen.
No one here really thinks Kosovo would be a top priority for a Trump administration, but Kosovo relies heavily on NATO, and Trump has questioned the U.S.'s commitment to the alliance. And then there's the way Trump has praised Russia's Vladimir Putin, who has consistently challenged Kosovo's international legitimacy. But Kosovo's ties to the U.S. run deep. Fitim and Kustrim were kids when Bill Clinton led the NATO bombing campaign in 1999. It ended Serbia's crackdown in Kosovo. In came thousands of NATO peacekeepers, including U.S. soldiers, who were stationed in their hometown, Jilan.
We were cheering them, too. We were welcoming them.
A soldier handed Fitim a ration pack.
I don't know if it tasted good or bad, but it tasted good in memory, so because that was like a gift from a foreign soldier. It was exciting.
And Kosovar's love for the U.S. has endured across three presidencies. There's a statue of Bill Clinton on a boulevard named after him. It intersects with George Bush Street. And the American flag is a more common sight here than in many parts of the U.S. It even inspired a song, Thank You, USA.
Thank you, USA. You are my best friend.
It's all bolstered by the U.S. support of Kosovo's independence, millions of dollars of aid, and the continued presence of U.S. soldiers here as peacekeepers.
The United States is, for all of us, like this father figure, or this role model, yeah. We look up to the U.S. to just be like this overall model of freedom and everything that we want to achieve, too.
It would take a lot for Kosovars to sour on the U.S., but Fitim says Trump shouldn't take the relationship for granted.
We don't have, like, a lot of money here. We're not the richest part in the world, but maybe we will be devastated because we will feel cheated, to say the least, from, like, our role model, our greatest ally, our greatest friend.
Kustrim isn't worried. He says Trump's rhetoric about NATO and Muslims was just a ploy.
I think that he just played us.
Kind of like their website. For The World, Nate Tabak, Pristina.
For Nate Tabak, the U.S. election is also personal. He got married last summer. Hannah Marcou, his wife, is originally from Kosovo, but has Canadian citizenship. Nate is a U.S. citizen. The couple were undecided about where they'd eventually settle down. Should they move to the U.S. or to Canada? But the election has made that choice much more clear. Hannah spoke to us from Toronto and Nate from Kosovo.
Basically, it comes down to a really, I think, a very tangible issue. And that on Hannah's side, she has some Muslim heritage. They're not religious people. But based on some of the things that Trump has said in the campaign, I would be worried that Hannah and our future children could be subjected to things like registration or additional screening and just all sorts of things. And I just don't think it's fair to subject children who don't have a say in the matter yet to that.
Hannah, tell me how you felt on a week ago on November 9th.
When I found out that Trump had been elected, my first emotion, quite frankly, was fear. And that's because of the rhetoric that Trump and Trump supporters used, you know, throughout the election campaign. And, you know, it turned out that fear was justified. I've been really horrified reading about the spike in hate crimes that have been taking place across the United States since he became elected. And, you know, my fear before the election was that hate groups would feel liberated after a Trump victory, and it turns out that's exactly what happened. And I could just as easily fit into one of those categories of, you know, hated people or hated minorities. America, at least to me, turned into a much darker place than it was a week ago.
So, Hannah, you're a Canadian citizen, right?
Yes.
So it'll be easy for you to move to Canada. Am I wrong about that?
Well, I am in Canada right now. And, you know, part of the decision for us coming here is we met in Kosovo. I'm a Kosovo Albanian. And Kosovo is the kind of country where there is, you know, an autocratic political elite that can kind of run roughshod over ordinary people. It is the kind of place that has highly documented instances of sexism and racism. And just about 10 days ago, there was an opposition activist who died while in detention. And I don't want to draw a direct comparison, but Nate and I have been living in a place where this can just happen. And it's terrifying to think that one of the world's largest democracies can also become a place in which these things can just happen. It doesn't matter if Donald Trump actually goes through with everything that he is saying. It's enough that the floodgates have been opened, and now it's okay to tell people to go back to Africa or to draw swastikas on the homes of Jewish people. This has become a new normal in a big part of America. And, you know, that made the decision very clear for us.
And I think what just is really, really sad about this is that the U.S. was, you know, was the first place where Hannah's family went when they escaped, you know, what was Yugoslavia in the early 90s, really escaping some of the very same things we're talking about right now. And I find it very sobering and just very sad personally that this country, you know, at least in my view, is not that place anymore, not really a place of refuge.
Nate Tabak in Kosovo and Hannah Marcou in Toronto. They got married last summer and will now be living in Toronto. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
You are listening to The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. When you're in Miami, you hear a lot of people speaking Spanish. It's a big part of the city's identity.
I really feel like if you don't know some Spanish in Miami, then you are definitely missing a lot of what it means to live here.
But Miami isn't quite as bilingual as you think. That story coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston.
Hey, Marco. I got a super story for you today. And you know what? It was my first story for our World in Words podcast, and it was super fun.
This is The World's Maria Muriel in the studio with me. And you're not kidding. You recently reported a super story for our language podcast, The World in Words. And all this week, we are featuring stories from the podcast.
Are you trying to copy my Miami accent?
Well, because, just on the word super, I wasn't even sure what
totally
my motivation
can't do
was.
It.
I'm not from there. But you're from there.
Yeah, I am. And the Miami accent is a really beautiful thing, I think. It's sort of sing-songy. You know, we're super Southerners. and we love this word, super.
I am super bloated.
Super white.
Super faded.
Super hungry.
Super constipated.
Ew, super gross.
Yeah, super, super. So as a Miamian, Maria, you, like a huge percentage of Miamians, are bilingual.
That's right. A lot of us in the Magic City speak more than one language, and I've spoken Spanish all of my life. My family moved from Peru to the U.S. when I was little. And so many people in Miami speak Spanish that sometimes it's called the capital of Latin America. But Miami isn't as bilingual as you might think.
All right. Here is an excerpt from your story on The World in Words.
Miami is salsa and Cuban coffee and black beans and Spanish.
Lisa.
But it's not true that everyone speaks it. Some people have to try really hard, like my friend Alicia, who's ordering food here at Enriqueta's Cafe downtown.
Okay. Café con leche. Sin azúcar, por favor. Gracias.
She's doing pretty good, actually.
I'm impressed. I think you've gotten like a lot better since the last time we were here and I heard you talking Spanish.
As a newsroom, we offer Spanish classes to our staff.
Alicia was my editor when I worked at WLRN, the public radio station there. She thinks it's important to know Spanish in Miami, especially for journalists who might have to interview Spanish speakers who don't speak English.
It's a survival skill in Miami. I really feel like if you don't know some Spanish in Miami, then you are definitely missing a lot of what it means to live here. I mean, a lot in terms of the culture, but also literally like a lot day to day of what's going on.
Alicia's from New York, and she's not Latina. But she's not mad about this. She just thinks it's the reality. And it's important to learn Spanish because Miami is so bilingual. Except, in some ways, it really isn't. Almost 70% of people in Miami-Dade County are of Latin descent. But we don't really conduct government or education in Spanish. And for a long time, bilingual education has been a hot issue in Miami. I mean bilingual education like going to school and learning math in Spanish, then science in English. Some people call that dual language immersion. And that's not the norm in Miami right now. Kids just take Spanish class like a foreign language, the way most people do. Like I took French in high school for about an hour a day.
We have school districts in Utah who have fully established, totally articulated dual immersion bilingual education programs. And in Miami, the best we can do is do an hour of Spanish as a foreign language. To me, that's not right.
Philip Carter is a linguistics professor at Florida International University, which, like most of Miami-Dade County, is majority Latino. And here's the thing about this very weirdly Latin place. A lot of us Miamians speak Spanish because our families do, but some Miamians born in Miami and their children aren't so good at reading or writing it. In his linguist speak, Philip says this is being fluent but not proficient. And he says we've lost our reading and writing chops, our fully bilingual education, because of politics. But it wasn't always this way.
Bilingual education movement in the United States was actually pioneered here in the 1960s. And this was on account of the political will of Cuban exiles who came at the end of the revolution in 1959, 1960, 1961, 1962, who said, when we go back to Cuba, our kids need to be able to speak Spanish. And that was a compelling argument. Of course, they did not, in fact, go back. They stayed, and Miami became what it is today over the ensuing half century. But they made a compelling argument. And it was understood pragmatically. Okay, this makes good sense. There's this population here. They need both languages. Let's open a school. And it was so successful that people came to Miami, school districts from around the world, to study the Cuban-American experiment with bilingual education. And that lasted sort of through the 1970s. And then, boom, the 1980s came. Suddenly, the language issue became politicized. Things got shut down, and you started getting laws that were passed to make English the official language of the state and official language of the county and so forth.
He says this brought forward a sense of shame. A shame in speaking Spanish, even in a place like Miami. At first, I didn't understand what he was talking about. Remember Alicia, my friend who tries really hard to speak Spanish?
Entonces, estamos aquí en Enriquetas.
But it's more than just Alicia. I remember this Venezuelan lady on a bus one day, yelling at the driver because the driver didn't speak Spanish. The woman was saying, this is Miami. You should speak Spanish. So where's the shame? Philip doesn't like my story. He thinks the woman on the bus misrepresents the attitude towards Spanish in Miami.
A lot of the anecdotes that I hear about speak to me in Spanish are coming in working class neighborhoods and in poor neighborhoods. In affluent neighborhoods, you never find people demanding speak to me in Spanish. It's certainly not happening on the school board.
This is his thing. He thinks the absence of bilingual education is key to what's wrong with language in Miami.
Nobody gets upset over the fact that we have a 500,000 school children coming through Miami-Dade public schools getting no Spanish. and we're a Hispanic majority city.
Why do you care so much about this? You're not even Latin. Why are you blushing?
Well,
but really, what is it about this that drives you?
I care about social justice. I learned Spanish as a young child from undocumented immigrants from Mexico and North Carolina, which is where I grew up. And for many, 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 many years, I saw the struggle they went through because of language-related issues. Not only questions of access, so like, can you get around? You know, do you have access to the institutions? But also these issues of shame. Are you assumed to be a particular type of person because of the language that you speak?
Yes, this is the shame Philip's been talking about. And after talking with him a couple times, I couldn't believe I hadn't gotten it at first. Because I felt that shame myself. I was in middle school when my family moved to the States. And kids that age can be so mean. I learned pretty quickly what not to be, what was not cool or good in the eyes of Miami tweens. One of those things was my accent. It wasn't cool. They called it refy, like from the word refugee.
That guy's mad refy.
It was a fairly nuanced insult for a middle schooler, I guess. It was a jab at that very large community of Cuban exiles I mentioned earlier. There's a whole thing here. The first wave of Cuban immigrants largely consider themselves and largely were of higher socioeconomic status than the waves of people who came later. So there's a bit of snootiness that comes with that. People who are fresh off the boat, or balseros, the ones who came on rafts, they're typically portrayed as having a certain kind of fashion sense, taste in music, as living in certain areas. They're stereotyped. So all those things associated with newcomers become refy. And those people become refs. And they likely don't speak English yet. Or they do, but not well. They sound refy. I didn't know how mean this was when I was little. I just knew that I didn't want to be called a ref. So I worked really hard to get rid of my accent. And I made friends with kids who lived their lives only in English, even if they were Cuban, Colombian, Nicaraguan, or whatever. I worked hard to assimilate into my very United States Latino suburban community of mean kids. And it worked. So much so that eventually it became weird among some of my friends that my parents didn't really speak English. I went from moving in the most Spanish circles of suburban Dade County to some of the least. To this day, most of my friends from high school speak primarily English. I'm not going to lie. I adopted some of those views back then. And I see how they still surface today. Sometimes I don't like to speak Spanish. But it's usually because I'm rude and immature and I don't want to make a conversation with a stranger. But it's not just about the words that come out of someone's mouth. It's about what starting a conversation with a stranger in Spanish says about the person speaking. Like when I go out to dinner with my family and my dad automatically speaks to a server in Spanish. For whatever reason, he just decides they're not a gringo and he speaks to them in Spanish. And then that server treats him rudely for so obviously being a person who prefers to speak Spanish. Or maybe the server treats him rudely for assuming that they speak Spanish too. That they are like him. But my dad thinks that's just what you do. He says it doesn't make sense for someone to not speak Spanish if they know how to. He likes to do it because he's better at it than English. And thinks when people don't like to speak Spanish, it's because they're ashamed of their culture or want to assimilate faster. So, that's kind of like I did. I didn't realize this when I was talking to him. I never felt like I was ashamed of my heritage. I'm actually really proud of being Peruvian, and I'd never want to pretend I'm not. But when I'm out at dinner with my family, I'll usually step in when the server looks uncomfortable and just place everyone's orders in English. It's just easier that way. But as I've been working on this story, I can't avoid one of my truths. I think part of me is still afraid of those mean kids from middle school.
part of me still wants to be the opposite of Refi. But a larger, better part of me understands that that's bullshit. I'm not ashamed of who I am. And I'm certainly not ashamed of my parents. When I went home to do this story, we ended up just chatting on the couch. We talked about how I used to translate all my school papers for them. I asked them if it ever bothered them that at 11, I had to translate everything for them, and in a way be the leader of certain family things that parents usually took care of. But they said no. They said they were proud of me. And I'm proud of them, too. When my dad first came to the States, he went to a job agency. He'd never had any foreign language training, and he was here alone. The rest of us were still in Peru. My dad had moved to Miami a year earlier than us to get settled and find, you know, like, a house for us. And he did odd jobs till he found full-time work. My mom starts telling the story and makes fun of my dad for lying on the job application. He said he spoke English, but only 60%, which was a lie. He spoke nothing. But Mrs. Robbins called. She was a very rich woman, and he was interviewing to be her handyman. He went to her house for the interview. She lived in a mansion on Star Island in Miami Beach, and Madonna and Gloria Estefan were her neighbors. When he got there, he said to her the only English phrases he knew.
Sí, le dije, good morning.
How are you?
Nice to meet you.
He did what he could.
Y me dio trabajo por seis años.
She hired him because his birthday was a day before her daughter's. And he worked there for 6 years. They used to give us Christmas presents, even though they were Jewish.
¿Y ahora qué porcentaje de inglés tienes?
Ahora llevo el 60%.
Now, he really is 60% fluent in English. And that's pretty good for roughly 15 years, especially in a place like Miami, where so many people speak Spanish, especially among the working class. My parents didn't need to be fluent in English as much as immigrants in other cities do. But if they had moved to another city in the U.S., they would have learned much more quickly. I left Miami earlier this year. I live in Boston now. And I find myself speaking Spanish more often, actually. In Miami, my Spanish and mi Latinidad, my Latinness, it was a given. Most of us somos Latinos in Miami. In Boston, I'm among white people, mainly, and I find myself asserting my heritage in ways I never did back home. I don't avoid speaking Spanish anymore, unless I don't want to chit-chat on a long Uber ride. I'm ashamed I ever used to pretend I didn't speak it, and I'm even more ashamed that I was ever ashamed of my accent. Now I live in a place where I feel I need to stand up for my heritage and own it more fully, where it would be much easier to lose my Latin roots. And it's so much harder to find good Cuban food.
My colleague Maria Muriel with an excerpt from her story for The World in Words. That's our podcast on languages and the people who speak them. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up, the Swedes tackle a pressing modern-day issue, mansplaining. Don't worry, I won't tell you any more than that for now. You're with The World. A political earthquake. A rebuke to an out-of-touch elite. No, not our election. I'm talking about how the surprise result with the Brexit referendum was described in the British press this summer. Britain voted narrowly to leave the European Union, and Donald Trump embraced that result as a good omen for his own campaign. Trump even promised that his victory would be Brexit times 10. We called Matthew Paris to talk about this. He's a British political commentator and a former Conservative Member of Parliament. Paris sees parallels between the Brexit vote and Trump's victory. Matthew, thanks for being with us. Where do Trump and Brexit line up? Do you see a parallel between the two?
I think they're both part of a phenomenon of a right-wing populist revolt against what they call the liberal metropolitan elite. Certainly the hardline Brexiteers have been taking huge pleasure in Donald Trump's victory and suggesting that it's all part of the same phenomenon. And I'm afraid some of the rather wounded remain in the EU people, like me, are also seeing parallels between the two. And to most of us on the Remain side of the argument, what carried Brexit despite the fact that it had some liberal intellectuals in its advance guard, what carried Brexit was a nativist, sometimes frankly racist, consistently anti-immigration surge of feeling in Britain. And we do see Donald Trump's victory as owing something to something rather similar on your side of the Atlantic.
But after the Brexit result, there were some reports of regrexit, of some British people changing their minds and wishing they had voted for the status quo. Is there a sense that the referendum would really have a different result if it were held again today?
Those of us on the Remain side of the argument keep living and hoping that there will be a groundswell of opinion amongst those who voted Leave, regretting their decision. There is some slight polling evidence of about 1% going over 2% at the most. That might actually change the result of the referendum. But what we are not seeing is a surge of regret amongst leavers. Not yet. Mm. But then, of course, we don't yet know what the likely terms of our leaving the European Union will be. So it's really very early to say.
So, Matthew, I mean, your track record goes back to the days of Margaret Thatcher. I'm very serious when I ask this. What do you think about democracy today?
I think all of us who have always thought of ourselves as Democrats, though we have by no means ceased to be Democrats, have in our private thoughts felt our confidence in the will of the people a little bit shaken by what has happened this year. We blame it perhaps a bit on the social media, perhaps a bit on the violence of the surges of opinion and of disinformation that can come from the social media. We blame it on anything we can find to blame it on. We'd rather not believe that the people can, as a considered long-term opinion, ever be wrong. But we're beginning to worry a little bit that perhaps the people can just get things wrong. I think that's a very long way from despairing of democracy, but it certainly has shaken our faith.
Political commentator Matthew Paris in London, thanks very much for your time and your thoughts.
Pleasure.
Finally today, mansplaining. You know, when a man starts explaining something to a woman, even though she didn't ask, kind of like what I'm doing right now. I'd have to be a little more condescending, I guess. Anyway, Sweden's actually got a hotline you can call if you're a victim of mansplaining. It's a brainchild of one of Sweden's largest trade unions, Unionen. Christina Knight is helping work the phones. She's the founder of Unite, which works to diversify ad agencies and communications companies in Sweden. Here's her definition of mansplaining.
I think often it's experienced as a sort of condescending exercise whereby the woman feels that the man feels a need to explain in perhaps a patronizing or condescending way where the woman hasn't actually asked to be informed or have an explanation, and perhaps even to the extent where the woman might already be more knowledgeable or more well-informed on the subject.
So tell us what kind of calls you've been getting on the hotline.
The calls have come in from all over Sweden, and from my point of view, I've had pretty much 50-50 men and women calling in, which is interesting and good. They've ranged from people who just want to say what a great initiative to people who are actually asking for strategies and tools in order to manage mansplaining that they feel that they're experiencing.
Yeah, what kind of things do the men want to know specifically?
Well, I had one wonderful call from a man who I think in his 30s, he'd had a call from his sister asking that he would visit her two sons, 13 and 10 years old, to inform them about mansplaining, which I thought was such a great thing to do, and not least for the man to take on this responsibility. So he was asking for tips and advice on how to address this subject for these two young men and how he could help them to avoid the phenomena of mansplaining. So I tried to equip him with some strategies and ideas on how he could talk about this.
What about any backlash phone calls, like people who are just kind of incredulous that this hotline exists in the first place?
I haven't personally received any of those. I'm sure there have been a couple. There's been quite an intense debate in social media. And I think, or I know, that was expected from Unionen, as is always the case, I think, when you discuss gender equality. And a lot of people, I guess primarily men, can tend to interpret the subject as an attack on them as men, which is such a shame because I know that the aim of this campaign and the aim of most sensible discussions on this topic actually aim to improve situations for both men and women. And in the case of this campaign, of course, the aim is to improve the climate in the workplace and make sure that everyone feels they're being listened to and being respected.
I got to say, from a distance, Sweden seems like a very egalitarian place. Do you think that the country really needs a mansplaining hotline and maybe some of the complaints were triggered by oversensitivity?
No, I think Sweden is in many ways doing well when it comes to working for equality. This specific campaign really is inspired by a need, both a need expressed by the members within Unionen and a need when you talk to women sort of generally, that they express that they have experienced this and it is troublesome and it is something that one would like to learn how to handle and inform people who are exercising mansplaining that become aware of what they're doing.
So, Christina, the next time you find yourself the object of mansplaining and there is no line to call, how will you react?
Well, I think it's important to talk to the person who is exposing you to this and say, do you know something I'm experiencing now that you're talking down to me or telling me something about that I actually really know quite a lot about? And I'd appreciate next time if you perhaps would start our conversation by asking me whether I'd like to know more, if I need to know more, or if I already know what I need to know.
Christina Knight is a consultant who works on gender equity and diversity. She's also been fielding calls on the mansplaining hotline this week, sponsored by the Swedish Trade Union. Christina, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I got nothing else. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.